The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Talking about changes, making a change in our life. Just something that people don't really often like to talk about or think about. And yet it is one of the most central themes of Jewish consciousness. Always having the openness, the flexibility, to be willing to see where it is that we're lacking, deficient, where it is that we can improve, what is it that we can change. A very basic concept in Judaism. If you remember, I told you the Hasidic story where the Rebbe saw these two fellows playing chess, and he said, I'd like to learn how to play that. And they said, sure, and they started to teach him the rules, and they said, Rebbe, when you make that move, you can't take it back. And the Rebbe said, not a Jewish game. In a Jewish game, you can always take it back. Okay? And so, it's about taking moves back. And the last two times we got together, we talked about three motivations for changing. Three motivations for changing: natural, faith, and reason. And we developed how they are connected to two categories in Judaism, which is fear and love. Sometimes people change out of fear. They're afraid of the pain, and they're looking for somewhat of a greater comfort. And sometimes people change, which is the higher mode, out of love. Now Rav Kook is going to turn to the process itself, not what motivates it, but two ways it can happen. Once it's being put into motion, whether it's out of fear or whether it's out of love, but there are two modes in the way tshuva, return, can happen. And so we read, this is from chapter 2, there is sudden tshuva, sudden repentance, and there is gradual repentance. Okay, let's read. In terms of time, penitence may be divided into two parts: sudden penitence and gradual penitence. Sudden penitence comes about as a result of a certain spiritual flash that enters the soul. It hits me. Alright? I want you to take a moment and try and reach into, remember, our most valuable bank, our memory bank. I'd like you to draw on your account. I'd like you to find a memory of a change that you made in your life that came about through a flash. It was something sudden, it was a realization, it was clear to you, and you did it, okay? It wasn't something gradual where you worked slowly in a methodological way towards the fixing of some kind of thing. The Gemara tells us about, this is the Gemara of Avodah Zarah. It talks about idolatry, but not everything is about idolatry, and it's page 17. It's about a man named Eliezer ben Dordai. And he was an incredibly corrupt person. And a prostitute that he was with said something, and it just hit him. And in that moment, because she said something kind of crass towards him, he changed within a second, and he decided that he would do tshuva, that he would repent. It then talks about how he asked the earth and everything in it that it should ask, it should beg compassion for. He started praying that the mountains pray for him, the sun pray for him, like, you know, the whole world should pray for him. But everybody basically refused and said, it's up to you. So what he did is he put his head between his knees and started to cry. He cried so hard that he died. Right, that's how much he cried over it, how perverted a life he lived. And he cried so hard, and at the moment that he died, a divine voice came out and said, Rabbi Eliezer ben Dordai. It wasn't a rabbi. He became a rabbi at that moment. You have now been invited to the eternal world, the world to come. And on this, the Talmud says, Rebbe was a great Talmud, said there are some people who acquire their world through many years of work, and some people acquire their world in a moment. Okay, and that was Rebbe Eliezer ben Dordai. In other words, here's a person who their entire life, you know, was really bad and did very bad things. and wasn't looking to change, wasn't trying to change. But this prostitute said something that just struck him so strong that something inside him just immediately responded. And he cried so hard that he caused himself to die, but he did in that moment do such tshuva, such repentance, that he, so to speak, got the world to come. I want to look at a piece on the bottom over here. This is referring to the story where Jacob walks in and he is pretending to be his brother Esav to get the blessings from his father who is blind, Isaac. Okay, and Isaac is mistakenly blessing Jacob, thinking he's Esav. All right? And so it says that Esav smelt his garments. Now the word for garments in Hebrew is beged. But the word beged also means to betray. Right? And of course it makes sense why. Where did we get the whole notion of garments in the first place? Why do we wear garments? Because in the Garden of Eden, the first man and woman did not wear garments, but after they sinned, they were given garments. And therefore the word for garment in Hebrew, which is a beged, also means to betray. Our garments remind us that we betrayed ourselves and we betrayed our relationship to God. Okay. So he smelt his garments. But the Midrash has a play on words. Not that he smelt his garments, but he smelt betrayal. And of course, the strange thing is there was a certain betrayal because it was Yaakov pretending he was Esav, right? And yet, the Midrash says he smelt betrayal, and yet he says, but you smell like the Garden of Eden. So he smelled a certain fragrance of the Garden of Eden, even in the betrayal. Alright, and that's a whole long class, which I'm not going to do, except what's appropriate for us right now. So let's look at the story. It refers to such as Joseph Meshitha and Yakum of Tzrarot. And it tells us two stories about two Jews much later, much, much later than Jacob's time. It's during the First Temple time. And what happened was, when the enemies desired to enter the Temple Mount, they said, let one of them, the Jews, enter first. All right? Isn't that the best way to demoralize and destroy people? By sending one of their own into the temple and say, you rip the temple off. You desecrate the temple. All right? So they found the Jew that was willing to do it. Said they to him, Joseph, enter whatever you bring out is yours. Now imagine what a rotten Jew this guy must have been. Because he's willing to betray the people and walk right in there and basically initiate the destruction of the temple by being the first one to loot it. Okay? So he went in and brought out a golden lamp. I mean, he didn't go for like a fork or something or a little cup. He went in and took something really valuable. Said they to him, it is not fitting for a common person to use this. Go in again and whatever you bring out be yours. In other words, what was their reaction to him? What was the enemy's reaction to Joseph when they saw him come out with a golden lamp from the temple? They said, that's too much. In other words, even these guys thought this was too much. This is way beyond desecration. And so they told them, put it back. In other words, they had greater moral sensitivity than this Jew did. Right? And so they say, put it back. At what point, then what happened? He, however, refused. Now all of a sudden he becomes a tzaddik, this big holy man. He refuses. Rabbi Pinchas said they offered him 3 years of taxes. Remember those days, the way they really used to get on your back is you'd pay taxes like mad. So they said, listen, we'll give you 3 years of taxes. All right? Yet he still refused. Is it not enough that I've angered my God once, he exclaimed, that I should anger him again? What did they do to him? They put him into a carpenter's vise and sawed him in sunder. While he cried out, woe, woe, I angered my Creator. Now what is the meaning of the story? This, the Midrash is saying, is a true story. This guy, Joseph, really exists. They have his name. It's Joseph of Meshitha. And this guy was so bad that he was willing to go in there, and he was even worse than that. He took a golden lamp, something that even they themselves would never fathom to do. Right? They tell him to go back, and all of a sudden he says, no, I won't do it. Isn't it enough that I've angered my God once? You want me to anger him twice? And he was so committed that he was willing to die rather than go in there again. So what happened? This is a perfect example of sudden tshuva. Where a person who could be so rotten, so far removed from Jewish sensitivity, something hit them. This Roman soldier said something to him and he realized, who am I? What am I? And it happens. Now, how can such a thing happen to such a person? I mean, obviously, he hit the lowest of the lowest. How can all of a sudden he reach such a high level he's willing to die than to commit such an offense? How does such a thing happen? It's called the soul. And this is what we've talked about before. We believe that the soul can only be covered over but never damaged. Do you follow? It's not like you can destroy your soul. You can cover it up. In other words, it's almost like putting mud all over it, and the light of your soul just doesn't get in. Or get out, actually. And what can happen is some situation, some remark, some prostitute, some Roman, somebody said something, or you saw something, and it just cracked everything through. And in the most mysterious way, you're able to perform feats of remarkable faith, right? Trust. How? Because we believe that within the human being is a spark of divinity called the soul. And that's something that you can deny, that's something you can cover up, but that's something that is still there, and something can break through and allow that soul to speak and say, I'm not going to do this. Yeah. I'm not going to do this. Let's read on a little more. It tells us another story. About Yaakov of Troas was the nephew of Rabbi Yossi ben Yoazir of Tzereda. Now Rabbi Yossi ben Yoazir of Tzereda was one of the greatest sages. And this is his nephew. His nephew was riding on a horse. He went before him the beam on which Rabbi Yossi was to be hung. Now the Romans took Rabbi Yossi and are going to hang him. And his nephew comes riding on a horse, sees his uncle about to be hung. And what does he say to him? And taunted him. See the horse on which my master has let me ride, and the horse which your master has made you ride. Ooh, what a horrible thing to say. How mean could you be? What was he saying? What? He sees his uncle, this great sage, being ridden off on a horse, carried off on a horse to be hung, right? And his nephew says, look what my master lets me ride. I mean, who's my master? Not God, but you know, maybe he had a Roman master, maybe worked for a Roman already. And look what your master, capital M, has made you ride. In other words, come on, who's got a better deal? I'm going free and you're going to die. But to have the chutzpah to say that, I mean, it's one thing maybe to think it, which is still pretty horrible. But to basically taunt your own uncle and say such a horrible thing before he's going to be killed. So what does his uncle answer? If it is so with those who anger him, how much more with those... Wait, where are we? Right. If it is so with those who anger him, how much more with those who do his will, he replied. Right? So what was his answer? He said, wow, look at you. Imagine you anger God, and look how nice he is to you. Imagine if you do his will. Do you understand? This is what the uncle is saying. The uncle is being carted off to die. Right? His nephew is making fun of him. He says, look at the horse I'm riding on. I'm riding on the horse of freedom. You're riding on the horse of death. The uncle answers back, well, look at that. See how nice God is to those who anger him. Imagine he'd be even nicer if you were to do his will. Right? Which is a sharp answer, but then again, but so why are you being carted off? Okay. So he answers him back. Has then any man done his will more than you? He jeered. Right? Answers back, good question. If it is thus with those who do his will, how much more with those who anger him? He retorted. Ooh, the uncle gave him a big one. He said, imagine if this is what God does to those who fulfill his will, right? Wait until you see what he's going to do to one who does not fulfill his will. And at that point, what happened? This pierced him, who's him? Yaakov, the nephew, like the poison of a snake. And he went and subjected himself to four modes of execution inflicted by the Bedouin: stoning, burning, decapitation, strangulation. Now, what does it mean? I don't know. But he obviously went through some huge metamorphosis whereby he realized how rotten he is and wanted to be punished for all his crimes. What did he do? He took a post and planted it in the earth, raised a wall of stones around it, tied a cord to it, he made a fire in front of it, fixed a sword in the middle of the post, he hung himself on the post, the cord was burnt through, and he was strangled, the sword caught him while the wall fell on him, and he was burnt. In other words, this guy did what? He's suicide, but like the most meshuggah suicide you can imagine. He figured out a way to build this thing where he would be fulfilling every form of capital punishment in Judaism to himself. Okay? Now obviously, you're not allowed to kill yourself. And yet, still there was some noble expression over here that he felt so bad, Yossi ben Yoezer of Sereda fell into a doze. He fell asleep. And what happened? And he saw Yaakov flying in the air. And he said, by a little while he has preceded me into the Garden of Eden. In other words, what then happened? Yaakov, this rotten guy who was teasing and ridiculing his uncle, who had this momentous transformation of desire so much to do tshuva that he actually killed himself, which is really wrong, but still it came from such an incredibly holy place that he made it to the Garden of Eden before his uncle. Alright? Now whether these stories are to be taken literally or not, I don't know. Right? I'm not sure. But what I'm sure is that these are stories to tell us about the incredible transformative possibilities within ourselves. Right? That nobody should ever say, it's too late, I'm too far gone, I'm too used to this, I've always been this way. It is possible for a person to transform in a moment, and yet it's not possible for a person to make that decision. All right? You can't decide to transform this moment. Right? But when it hits you, it hits you. Now let's read on a little bit. Sudden penitence comes about as a result of a certain spiritual flash. We're back to Rav Kook, second paragraph. It's a certain flash that enters the soul. Now where is this flash coming from that enters my soul? At once the person senses all the evil and the ugliness of sin, and he is converted into a new being. Now there's two things that happen, evil and ugliness. What's the difference between evil and ugliness of sin? Sin is evil, sin is ugly. What's the difference? Ugly is what? It's the way you look to others. Alright? Evil is evil. Judaism claims that when a person transgresses, it not only damages them in an inner way, but they really become ugly. You know? Really become ugly. They talk about it in the Kabbalah, they talk about it, the Ramban talks about it, that when a person transgresses, you can read it on their face. I mean, Judaism had this notion of criminology a long time ago, that you could literally read it on, so you can see it on their face that this person is not doing good things. Right? And so what can happen though when a person senses the evil and the ugliness of sin, not only what it does in terms of themselves, but in terms of how they appear to others, he is converted into a new being, already experiences inside himself a complete transformation for the better. This form of penitence dawns on a person through the grace of some inner spiritual force whose traces point to the depths of the mysterious. Now what is he talking about? What is this inner spiritual force? He first said that it's this flash that enters the soul, and then he said it's through the grace of some inner spiritual force whose traces point to the steps of the mysterious. What happens to a person? They have a moment of complete clarity. Where just something that they knew deep inside and always knew, but denied having it be expressed in a conscious way, it just hits them right away. You get, I would call, a tremendous perspective on who you really are, and what role you really play in this world, and how you relate to everybody else. Imagine if you walk into a party, and you're wearing a pink polka-dotted tie, right? Is there any reason why you'd wear this horrid looking tie and everyone's looking and laughing at you and you know, you look really stupid. You're wearing a tie that doesn't fit, it's too short, you know, it's ridiculous colors, right? Is it hard to take the tie off? It's very easy to take the tie off. What's hard? To see that I've got this dumb tie on. Right? In other words, if at one moment I get a chance to see myself in a mirror, it would be hard once I, you know, everyone's like, come on, take the time. You don't have perspective. You don't realize how silly it really looks and how belittling it is to who you are. Because you don't have a greater perspective on yourself within a greater reality. All right. So I don't know if I mentioned, you know, years ago when I was a kid, I was doing this play. It was called Little Abner, right? And I wanted to be Little Abner, although even, but Little Abner, if you know the play, is this big guy. And I got the part Marrying Sam. Now, Marrying Sam is a great part. In fact, Marrying Sam had more lines, and Marrying Sam had all these solos to sing. But I wanted to be Little Abner because the girl that was playing the lead, which I don't remember her name, Mary Lou or something. Anyone remember her name? Daisy May. Okay, Daisy May. You know, she's eventually going to marry Little Abner. Okay? And in real life, I was absolutely madly in love with Daisy May. You know, and when you're 12 years old, you know who your soulmate is. You know, you have that kind of clarity. Now, I thought to myself, listen, even though she's 14, that doesn't make a difference to me. You know, I'll wait another year, we'll get married. You know how it is when you really understand life. And so so I was madly in love with Daisy May. And it would just eat me up at all these rehearsals, especially since in the end I would marry her and Little Abner. I couldn't stand this guy. Anyways, and I had all these dreams, and I knew it was from God. There's no question, this is my soulmate, and I was really excited. This is going to be my soulmate. Well, after the play, my father, you know, was taking pictures of the play. And I was looking through these pictures. And I remember I got this one picture, and it was this really funny picture of this short guy next to this very tall girl. And I thought it just kind of looked a little funny. And I looked at it and I laughed and I said, oh, it looks really kind of funny. And then I realized that it doesn't look kind of funny. It looks like me and her on stage. At that moment, I was cured. I wasn't interested in her at all. Because I had a perspective from outside that I wasn't able to get from inside. Because from my point of view, I really thought people were taller than me. You know, I used to always think, because I could see eye to eye with people, and I wasn't kind of used to looking up like this. I didn't really get a sense that, yes, there are people who are long, you know, that are longer. There are people that are taller, people are shorter. I never had a sense that I was short. You know, never had a sense that I was short. But when I had that picture in front of me, and I saw how she was like two heads higher than me, I realized, you know, it was like that. It was like that. And a very similar kind of experience happened when I was much older, and I was dating a woman. It was very serious. We were dating very seriously. And we were in the Plaza Hotel. And we were sitting on one of the couches and just talking. And all of a sudden, I noticed in the reflection of these huge windows that are around the lobby of the Plaza Hotel, I noticed the reflection of this guy and this girl talking to each other on a couch. And I looked over, and then I looked and I realized, that's us. At that moment, it was just clear, this is not the shidduch. But I, you know, we were going on for quite some time, and I just couldn't see that perspective. In other words, there are moments where you have a clarity, where you see yourself within the context of a greater reality. And within that context, it's so obvious how far off you've gone, or how so much not in touch with yourself you are, and how little you've really respected what you need to be. And these are very rare moments, unfortunately. Right? But there, it's a moment that hits you. There's a certain grace of inner spiritual force, but that's a receptive force to get the flash from without that gives you a sense how you fit to see the scene objectively. And then, within seconds, you're cured. But how long does it take to get that kind of perspective? You know? But it's a huge perspective, an illumination that strikes you, and all of a sudden, it's so obvious. And then, it's not hard to get rid of whatever it is you're doing. And then you've really gone to the root of the problem. You know. Now, it's important to understand that sudden tshuva is not something you can do. That's what part of the, you know, that's what makes it sudden. It's not like, oh, I'm going to go have sudden tshuva now. Oh, I think I'm going to have sudden realization and transformation. But, so then what's the value of talking about it? I think the value of talking about it is to be aware that it can happen. Right? And I think when a person's aware of the possibility of such sudden tshuva, right? They're more open to it really happening to them. Remember I told you the story how Rav Nachman was seen numerous times walking down the street just stopping dead in his tracks and not moving. And it looked really bizarre, you know? I mean, of course it would be bizarre, especially if it was in the middle of traffic or something. It would be bizarre. And people asked him, what are you doing? And he said, if you have a moment where repentance hits you, don't move. He said, don't let go of it. These are such rare opportunities where something hits you, a certain insight for the possibility and the reality and the importance and the necessity of making a change. And if you don't take the chance to kind of like stop and integrate that moment, you know, digest that moment, you've missed an important, important moment, you know, which could have really taken you to such a high level, high level. Now, I don't know if I ever mentioned to you, it's a very beautiful analogy, that if a person is on a ship and they're leaving from Los Angeles and they're sailing in the direction of Australia, if they are actually off by like 1 degree, they'll end up in Japan. It's just really 1 degree. People think like, you know, oh gee, it's really nothing, I'm just doing this, and you know, it's a small thing. People don't realize that on a life journey, small things, very 1 degree, can totally, totally take you to a completely different place that you had no plans for. And you know, it's very easy, well, we were just fooling around, we're just having some fun, whatever. That's something very small, but people don't realize that it's something very small that can totally divert your journey. So just imagine a 1 degree realization in your life. And how absolutely treasured those moments are. And to be able to take the time to say, wow, this is such a special moment we really remember. I mean, right now it's Elul, we're in Jerusalem, we're in the backyard of the most holiest place according to Judaism, holiest place in the world. You know, we're learning for 3 weeks, good environment, good friends, you know. What better time to start working on really making changes than now? If I'm not going to do it now, when am I going to do it? You know? When I'm in the middle of my job, or when I'm running out trying to pay my bills? And so there's such special opportune moments where we could be so receptive, we could be so open to really look at ourselves and try and really grow. And so that's why I think this is important to see this, that yes, sudden tshuva does happen, has happened. I think it's important that you look back in your life and try and find those moments, right? So you hold on to those moments, because there's still some juice in those moments. You remember I mentioned a good source for getting a sense of ourselves is some of the works of Escher. Have you seen some of his wood carvings and drawings? He's got this remarkable way about him, which enables him to show different figures that are completely interfaced. Each figure seems to be an independent reality, when in fact it's got a completely dependent reality on everything around it. All right? He's got this fantastic picture of individuals. It's one of my favorites. You know, individual faces. Women, men, young, old. But they're totally interfaced. In other words, his chin is her forehead, and her nose is his ear, and everybody, and from their perspective, from within, each one feels that they're very unique and special, having nothing to do with the other person. In fact, they might even feel that the other person is cramping their style. You know, like you're a little too close, you know, like you're a bit moving in on my personal boundaries. And they don't realize that it's precisely, they exist as a manifestation of the whole picture from this vantage point. Do you hear this? In other words, not one of those images is an independent image. Each image is the culmination, the manifestation of a total buildup of all the images, and it's really a picture of the whole from a particular vantage point. Now that's a good feel for what it means to be created in the image of God. That each and every one of us is really a particular manifestation of the all. Right? And we're all interconnected. Nobody's independent. It's absolutely an illusion according to Judaism. to think that you have an independent reality. You don't. We are totally interconnected. We are totally interdependent. All right? And what I do affects you, and what you do affects me. Now, what happens is that what I could do to myself is begin to live a lifestyle which is very promotive, you know, very indicative of this illusion that I'm separate, independent, having nothing to do with anybody else. But that's the illusion. When I lift myself out of the greater reality, which is really my environment, my context, my content, my ground, I can't exist outside of this greater reality. Although I sometimes think I can, and sometimes pretend I can, and do things which are really contrary to living in touch with the allness wherein which I truly exist. Okay. That's what happens. We'll talk about that later too. A transgression comes from this illusory sense that I can do whatever I want because I'm separate, I'm independent, do my own thing. Right? There's no such reality of do your own thing. Because we're all so connected. Your thing is my thing. My thing is your thing. It's all connected. Right? And so this spiritual, this flash from outside is a flash of the all-embracing reality whereby you begin to realize, you sense how much the all is at the very center of yourself. Right? And at that moment, it's just clear to you, you can't be this, you don't want to be this because it's not you. It's just really not you. And those are very... Gee, there are just the most special moments in our lives. And I think they would happen more often if we were just open to letting them happen. Right? Letting them happen. I think part of this is very much a prophetic kind of experience. You know? And prophecy comes to a person when they're happy. You know, when you're in a basically good frame of mind, it's more likely to happen. Because you can't get prophecy if you're not happy. It's a rule in Judaism. Alright? And you're clear. All these things make you a little more open. They say the prophets would use music. It's a very healthy thing to listen to a little music every day. At least once or twice a week. But you know, sit down and really kind of close your eyes and relax and just listen to some music. Hopefully good music. All this can open us up to be receptive to that flash. But I suggest that that flash is a flash of the greater perspective that I don't have. This is what's called in Kabbalah mochim de gadlut, in contrast to mochim de katnut. There's something called expanded mind, great mind. Moach is mind. Gadlut is great, expanded. Right. Some people call it cosmic consciousness, if you want it, if you will. But there's something called mochim de katnut, which is small-mindedness. Let's think of some small-mindedness, right? Whereby you get all of a sudden so caught up in some detail that within the context of your life is so stupid. And you're just so trapped in this. You're so angry, you're so put off by it, but it really is not, it's such a small thing, but you've gotten so in touch with it, you can't see it within context. Have you maybe once in a while had that experience? And you're so aggravated about the fact that you walked into a store and you paid a dime more. Now, okay, it's a fortune to have to pay a dime more. But is it not more unfortunate to start eating yourself up over the whole thing in the contrast of the rest of your life? You know? And so it has to do with context. It's like, imagine you're on a bus, and it's really hot and sweaty, and you don't have a seat, you can barely hold on to the thing, and you're really feeling rotten, right? But if you knew that you're only on this bus for 3 minutes, would that really get you upset? No. It wouldn't get you upset. You know, just 3 minutes. You'd put it in perspective. Right? But what if you were on this bus for like the next 10 years? Oh my gosh. Now that would be horrifying. So you always have to put things in perspective. You have to kind of like, if you're sitting there and you're getting really anxious about a bus that's not coming on time, you have to ask yourself, well, how much time do I really have to spend on this bus? How important is this bus in my life? right? What role does it play? And all of a sudden you start to see, this is really very small. It's like I might have mentioned to you before, there's something I loved about the Gulf War, which sounds pretty masochistic, but what can I do? Of course, it's a horrifying thing to think that some insane madman is trying to kill you. But I tell you, put things in perspective. When I would hear that, you know, for me, whenever I hear the shofar blows, it reminds me of these sirens going off. When I would hear those sirens, all the garbage would melt away so fast. I'd look at my children like I never looked at them before. I'd look at my wife like I never looked at her before. I would, all of a sudden, I wouldn't worry about those bills anymore. I mean, all those little things, you know, this person said that to me. You know, it was like all these stupid things that people can spend so much time getting aggravated and eating themselves up and getting so upset, all melts away because all of a sudden you've got a greater picture, right? You also put it all in the context of, hey, life, that's it, right? That's what it's all about, life. And so I call it wide-angle lenses and zoom lenses. See, some people are wearing these zoom lenses, and they zoom in on everything, and everything gets on their nerves because they're thick, because everything is so huge. It's like, imagine I've got a tiny cut over here, but with my zoom lenses, oh my gosh, there's a crater in my arm. I'm gonna die, and I could freak out because because I have these zoom lenses. All I can see is this little thing, right? And if I look at it in the context of the whole, I say, oh, it's just a tiny little scrape. It's nothing, right? Wide angles, you see it, but you see it within perspective. Zoom angles, zoom lenses, you see everything, and all of a sudden it becomes the perspective. Rather than being a tiny part of the whole, you start to think it's the whole story, it's the whole point, it's the whole thing. And that's when we really make serious, serious mistakes in our lives. And that, I think, is what sudden tshuva is all about. Sudden tshuva happens when all of a sudden, bink, I have these wide angles. And I start seeing everything in a much greater perspective. And I realize this is so small, and this is so unimportant, right? And what is really, really valuable? And that's very hard to do. You know, that's very, very hard to do because people are just so in touch with these details, and don't see the details within the context of the whole story of their lives. That's the next one, which is called gradual tshuva. Of course you have to focus in on details, but you still can't get lost in the details. You have to have perspective. How bad really is this? Right? How urgent really is this? Right? How painful really is this? It's all perspective. You know, they say a story about a woman. She came into a doctor's office, and the door of the doctor's office was a tiny bit open, and she saw the doctor taking pins and literally jabbing this little boy, you know, in his feet. And the little boy is screaming, crying, right? And the mother standing beside this little boy as this doctor is in the most vicious way putting these pins into his feet, and the little child is screaming, right? And the woman is horrified. She's about to run for her life from this doctor, and it's just about to leave. The mother walks out and she's in such a state of happiness. She says, oh, I'm so happy. The woman looks at her and she says, lady, you're so crazy. So what are you talking about? She says, how could you stand there and let this doctor put these pins into your son's feet? She said, my son hasn't felt anything in his feet for 10 years, right? And he's finally responding. And it was just such ecstasy for him and me. Perspective, right? All of a sudden, everything looks absolutely different. I was in Los Angeles, and I was in this park, and I saw this woman. She was sitting on a wall. She had her head turned like this, and she was just madly talking. And I looked at her, and I sat there, and I watched, and I felt so sorry for this woman who had obviously lost her mind. And I thought, that's quite common. You know, you see a lot of people lose their minds out there. You know, and so I felt so sorry for her. And then I should I talk to her? There's nothing I can do for her. No, she was nuts. She was simply talking to the air in such a, you know, frantic way. I felt I can't help her. As I'm walking away, I walked by the wall, and there was a guy right on the other side. He was talking to her, right? But it was perspective. From one perspective, she looks absolutely insane, and nobody could have ever convinced me that she wasn't insane. All of a sudden, when I saw the whole picture, she wasn't insane at all. But getting the whole picture, that's the hard thing. That's the hard thing about Judaism too. I think the reason why so many Jews have become so estranged to Judaism is they don't have the whole picture. I mean, if you just see these little details taken out of the context, it looks a little crazy. You know, all of a sudden people munching on these crackers one night when really I should be watching the championships on television. I mean, it's kind of silly that we're going to spend our times tonight when the Oscars are playing or when I could really see the Ten Commandments in living color and waste my time eating these crackers. You know, and if you don't have a greater perspective on it, it does seem kind of silly. You know? And a lot of it looks really crazy. Out of perspective, just about everything out of perspective looks silly. When you put in perspective, right, it just looks so incredible. And this is part of sudden tshuva. A lightning in the darkness of darkness. All of a sudden, you see things you didn't see before. You realize things that you never realized, or you felt things you never felt before. Because it just hit you so strong. Now again, you know, it can be a little depressing because it's not something I can just generate. But I do believe if I'm open to it, then maybe there are more of these sudden tshuvas that hit us than we realize. And maybe we just didn't let it get deep enough. Maybe the lightning bolt did strike me, but I was so resistant to it that I didn't let it do the work it should have been doing. But that's sudden tshuva. Let's look at the other form of tshuva, which is the normal form, and this is the one that we generally do. There's also a gradual form of penitence. No sudden flash of illumination dawns upon the person to make him change from the depth of evil to the good. But he feels that he must mend his way of life, his will, his pattern of thought. I mean, I don't have this sudden, wow! I wasn't on the bus and it hit me that I gotta be different. Right? But all of a sudden, it's not a sudden thing, it's just, I'm just feeling generally yuck. And I just feel like there's no reason for me to feel yuck. I don't have to feel this way. You know, we've talked about this before. I mean, people in my office have talked about this before. There's something very comfortable about staying the way we are. You know, we know we're not happy. We know we're feeling yuck. But like, it's at least secure. At least it's something I'm familiar with. And we often can't opt for that which is familiar over that which is risky. Life is risk. You really got to take a risk to make a change. Because you don't know where it's going to lead you. You know? You don't know where it's going to lead you. It's like, I'm sure I mentioned, it's like dating some guy or some woman, and on your first date, you're already wondering, how am I going to pay for the mortgage? I mean, and how are we going to get our eldest son into medical school? And you're sitting with this person, you realize they're totally preoccupied, and you say, excuse me, are you with me? And finally say, I can't go through with this. I mean, how can you expect me to make a commitment to two cars, a cat, one dog, five children, and a mortgage? That's really unrealistic. And you're looking at it like, hello. You know? And we do this to ourselves because we like to shoot ourselves in the foot. We like to think about what could be. We love to think about the future. You know, as my wife always tells me this story she remembers when she was a kid. And it's about this little girl, and she found this egg, right? And she's so excited, and she's carrying this egg, and she's thinking, my gosh, with this egg, I'm going to have a chicken. This chicken is going to give me five more chickens. And from those five chickens, I'm going to have 15 chickens. I'm going to take the 15 chickens. I'm going to sell them. Then I'm going to buy this, and I'm going to buy that. She's getting so excited. She's thinking about everything that's going to happen. And so she's so involved with what's going to happen, she trips and breaks her egg, right? And that's the end of the story. But that's something that happens to us all the time. We're just so into our images, our dreams, our imagination. And we just forget, like, what do I have to do now? And let me do what I have to do now. And I just, you know, have to have the guts to take this step. I don't know where it's going to take me. And it really shouldn't be so much of my business, although I do have to have a whereabouts about myself. But nonetheless, I can't, I'm not a prophet, I don't know where it's going to take me, I don't know what's going to be. But gee, life can be so boring if I'm not willing to take those risks. And I've got to take those risks because then there's just no reason to get out of bed. There's just so many diseases out there, so many horrid people out there trying to kill people. I mean, there's so many reasons not to get out of bed. Because gradual tshuva, it's not a sudden flash, it doesn't dawn on me, but I just look and I realize, you know, I could do better. I'm not in the right, perfect place. By heeding this impulse, he gradually acquires the ways of equity. He corrects his morals, he improves his actions, he conditions himself increasingly to becoming a good person until he reaches a high level of purity and perfection. It's a whole other way. I go in a very systematic, slow pace. I pick the flaw I'd like to change today, or this week, or this year. I slowly work on it. I develop towards it. It's a completely different kind of tshuva. Right now, I think probably the sudden tshuva is a little more attractive, because I don't have to do anything about it. Gee, I wish it would just hit me. Sometimes it does. But sometimes it doesn't. You can't wait for the does.
And even if it does, you have to do something about it.
That's right, because, you know, it who says it's going to stick? Who says it's going to last?
Led by your conscience?
Yes, he says it's a general feeling. He says, you know, it doesn't dawn upon a person, but he feels that he must mend his ways. You just feel you've got to mend your ways. It's not
nagging.
It might be nagging. It might be just a little gnawing. It might be a little kvetching. I don't know exactly what it is, but, you know, it's a general feeling of, you know, it's not something sudden. It's just you feel in a total way you need a general tune-up, and you feel you should do something about it. And that is what he calls the gradual form of tshuva. Now, the higher expression of tshuva comes about as a result of a flash of illumination of the all-good, the divine, the light of him who abides in eternity. Now, he's now referring to the sudden tshuva as the higher form. Because the higher form really is coming from a mysterious beyond place, and that itself is demonstrating a tremendous connection in some way, you know, under all that. So he says, the universal soul, the spiritual essence, is revealed to us in all its majesty and holiness to the extent that the human heart can absorb it. Now this, I think, is the key word. How much can your heart absorb it? The universal soul is making itself manifest. Here the word universal soul is, you know, God. And that opportunity is there. The question is, how receptive is my heart? How really receptive is my heart? And the Bietzna Rebbe refers to this cleansing meditation, which we did a little bit of, where you meditate and you just focus and just watch your thoughts. And he says that if a person watches their thoughts, they will realize that their mind is so bombarded with so many different thoughts that they're literally insane. And that the only difference between themselves and an insane person is that an insane person actually acts upon all those thoughts. And the difference is that we have all these crazy thoughts too. We just don't react to them. We just let them flow through us. We don't realize how cluttered our brains really are and how much is going on in our brains. So are we really receptive? If that flash came through, could it get through the cesspool of knowledge and thoughts and worries and anxieties that have just clogged my brain? Do I need some Brain-O? You know? That's what I'm doing. I'm so congested that how will I be able to, you know, that flash, will it get through? Will it really get through? And so, it's to the extent that the human heart can absorb it. So the Pietzna Rebbe says that it's important that a person take time to do this cleansing, you know, to kind of watch your thoughts. And just become aware of the fact that you are congested. And that itself makes you less congested. Because you don't get drawn into your thoughts. Because what happens with thoughts is they carry you and you go in all these directions. So if you can watch them, and realize that you don't have to become your thought. If you think of a frog, that doesn't mean you become a frog. Right? If you think of a cat, that doesn't mean you become a cat. But we do kind of get drawn into our thoughts, even though we may not act upon our thoughts. But we can get drawn in by our thoughts, and then end up being very, very fragmented and very, very frayed at the ends. And so the Pietz and the Rebbe said it's very important that every day a person takes time to kind of watch their thoughts. And not get trapped in their thoughts. And I think this is a very important idea in terms of the human heart absorbing this flash of the all good. Now, what is the flash of the all good? Because Judaism believes that when God looked at creation, he said, Tov mi'od. It's all good. And so what makes me change is when I realize that I, who am not all good, live in this context of all good, and I simply don't fit. You know? And I want to fit. I need to fit. But I don't. No matter how long did it take me to realize I don't fit? I'm like a square trying to put myself into a round, you know, into a circle. I don't fit here. Because really, the all good is what life is all about. And I'm not all good. And so when I get a taste of that all good, it kind of reminds me of the hidden all goodness within me. And, oh, you know, I'm just sore. I get just so drawn by it. Indeed, is not all of existence so good and so noble? And it's not the good and the nobility in ourselves, but an expression of our relatedness to the all. You follow this, right? Because if you remember this Escher picture, each individual, their personal definition is the all. That's really their essence. Their essence is, they are really a particular manifestation from a certain vantage point of the all. And so when they get a sense of the goodness of the all, and that sense of the goodness of the all awakens that point of goodness within myself, because I'm so related to that all. How can I not want to do tshuva? You know, it's just like, it's just so obvious. How then can we allow ourselves to become severed from the all? A strange fragment detached like tiny grains of sand that are of no value. Now he's saying something so beautiful. And he's always saying things beautiful. But here, it's especially beautiful. What is the word for something that is not holy? In Hebrew, chol. Chol. You know what chol also means? Chol? Sand. So it's no accident that he's using the word sand here. That all of a sudden you feel like a grain of sand. What makes something not holy? The fact that it's not whole. Right? It's not one. It's a granule which is severed and separated from a greater context. Right? And that's what makes it not holy. All right? And the Jewish tradition is all about being holy. What does it mean to be holy? It means to see myself in the context of the all. To define myself in terms of a greater reality. And no longer see myself as a severed, independent, tiny granule. Right? But rather one with the all. As a result of this perception, when a person realizes the allness and the goodness of the allness, and that reminds them of the goodness inside themselves, right? They can't bear to be severed from it. Because they realize that that goodness inside themselves is precisely a derivative of the fact that essentially they are connected to the all. They're simply living a lifestyle that suggests just the opposite, right? And so what I think Rav Kook is telling us here is part of doing tshuva is getting in touch with your goodness, right? And it's a basic Hasidic idea. It's brought down in the verse, Sur Meira Vasei Tov, remove yourself from evil and do good. So the Hasidim used to explain that, well, how do you remove yourself from the evil and do good? They say, do good, and that will remove you from your evil. It was if you focus on and you develop the goodness in you, right? Then that goodness will give you the strength and the confidence and the realization that you don't want this bad stuff. It's just so incongruent with what you are really essentially you. So as I mentioned, when you walk into a party, you're wearing this pink polka dotted, why are you wearing it? If you knew it didn't fit you, you'd never wear it. You just don't know it doesn't fit you. My sister and I went into a dress store. My sister wanted to go get a dress. We were in Toronto, and there was this guy named Jacques who was this designer. He sells designer clothing. Now, he's very smart. His name's Jacob Stein, right? But Jacob Stein could never be a designer, so it's Jacques. Yeah. You know? This Yiddish man comes out, yeah, Jacques, my name is Jacques. So he comes out, and he's very brilliant, because he's not only the designer, but he's also the salesman. So we're standing there in this store, and we're looking at the prices. This is supposed to be like a half-price sale, when you realize, you know, like, this is half-price. Wow. Like, I can't even afford it if you go down to 1/16th price. Okay. But it was kind of fun to be in this store, and this elder woman came in, a very sophisticated person, very classy, high-class lady. She comes, she's so shocked. Oh, Mrs. Feinberg, it's so good to see you. Oh, it's so great to see you, Jacques. Well, I'd like to buy a dress. I'm going to the... Oh, yes. So he says, so everybody's kind of waiting because they're... It's really exciting to hear the recommendations of Jacques. So Jacques, he says, oh, Mrs. Fines, I've got something for you. Right? So he goes over to the wardrobe and he looked to me random, but I don't know. He must know his stock very well. And he goes, this is for you. And he takes out, and everybody, of course, is really ready to see what he recommends. And it's this lime green kind of like you'd want in a black light room. Like, it was like crazy. It was just absolutely not her. And her first reaction was, you know? And he said, she said, no, no, Jacques, I couldn't. He says, Mrs. Feinberg, I'm telling you, I know this is you. This is you. Just put it on. So she says, no, I couldn't. It's not my age. It's not my color. It's you. Put it on. Finally, okay, fine. She goes in, and everybody in the store is all excited, like, see this lady walk out in this thing. Well, fine. She gets dressed. She comes out. She's wearing it. And you sensed in the store that everybody died. When she walked out, it was just really not her. And then she stood in front of the mirror, and you could see the expression on her face of the shock, like, this is not me. Of course, he's very quick. He goes, it's you. And he says, it's you. I tell you, this lady, she starts writing this check, this huge check. It's so easy to think it's me. When I realize it's not me, I'm finished. But that's the problem. When does it hit me that this is just not me? You know, this is really not me. This is what my parents said maybe I should. This is what my peers. Maybe this is what the commercials say is me. Maybe this is what the movies say is me. What is me? Right? Judaism says that the essence of you is goodness. You are goodness. And you have to get in touch with that goodness because you are that. Right? And anything that just does not fit goodness does not fit you, and you know it. You just know that. But it's something that, unless we get in touch with that goodness and realize how we so much want to resonate with the goodness around us, outside of us, and it's the goodness inside of us, which is precisely a function of our relationship to that all-embracing goodness outside of ourselves. When I get in touch with that, it's just not me. I don't want to do these sins. It just doesn't interest me. It's not me. As a result of this perception, which is truly a divinely inspired perception, comes about penitence out of love, and in the life of the individual, and in the life of society. What is penitence of love? He now gives us a better clue. It's when I realize how the inside of myself, that inner goodness in me, is so bound up with the all-embracing goodness of reality, which we call God. And it's so clear to me that I don't want to be severed from that, because I am part of that. And I always was part of that. And all this other stuff I've been doing, is it really me? Is it really me? So what Rav Kook has done for us is a number of things. He's given us a sense of the two forms that tshuva can happen. Not the motivation so much, but more the process. Right? And there are two processes. One sudden, one gradual. He seems to indicate that the sudden flash is a higher mode, but one that you can't actively go and do, but you can be actively receptive for when it happens. You know, and that receptivity is, I want to be ready in my heart, open in my heart, that when clarity does hit, it sticks. It really gets me there. This is one of the understandings of the shofar, right? The shofar, one of the words we use is tekiya. Not tequila, tekiya. Right? What does tekiya mean? Litkoa means to take a stake, you know, a peg, and drive it into the ground. Right? Litkoa means to drive something into the ground. So one of the understandings of tekiya is when you hear that, you should take yourself and drive yourself into the ground of existence, which is God. Right? Which is really our source, our ground, our context, our environment. And our inner goodness itself is a manifestation of that all-embracing reality which we're part of.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.